Hello everyone and welcome back to the third and last live episode of The Sediment at ASBN 2022. The Sediment will record a fourth episode after the conference is concluded where we will discuss Monday's programming. We have so many great guests on today, so without further ado, let's jump into introductions. I am Sudha Garimella, podcast editor of ASBN, and in my free time, I work as a pediatric nephrologist at Prisma Health Upstate, University of South Carolina. Our first guest tonight is Dr. Varghese.
Hi, I'm Priya Varghese. I'm from Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. It's really fun to be here. A fun fact about myself is that I have been bitten on the cheek by a monkey.
A monkey?
A monkey indeed.
Oh my God. I don't know if anyone can top that today. Our next guest on the panel tonight is Dr. Nelson.
Yeah, I'm Raul Nelson. I'm from Primary Children's Hospital, University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Fun fact, I love to ride camels on the Sahara Desert. That was my adventure pre-COVID.
Oh, wow. My goodness. Everyone has exotic fun facts tonight. Our next guest on the panel is Dr. Brady.
Hi, I'm Tammy Brady. I am at Johns Hopkins University, and my fun fact is I once took a DJ class with Biz Markie.
Ooh.
Super fun.
Whoa, DJ class. We're acquiring quite a lot of musical talent amongst ASBN members now. We need to have a band. All right, moving on. Our next guest is Dr. Menon.
Hi, I'm Shaina Menon. I'm from Seattle Children's Hospital. My fun fact is Dr. Varghese and I are from the same state in India. And I have also been scratched by a monkey when I was helping out with the hospital in India.
Okay.
Kind of in the middle of a kidney transplant, I was going to the blood bank to fetch blood, and I got scratched by a monkey.
I'm also from India. For those of you who want to go to India, I can vouch that I have never been near a monkey, so you can visit, okay? Don't be scared. You're giving a bad name to India. Our next guest is Dr. Rowe.
Hi, I'm Michelle Rowe from the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And my fun fact is that I took up biking during the pandemic and just spent 10 days biking through the south of France. So that was a lot of fun.
That's amazing. You know, you did something healthy, whereas I just ate potato chips. So,
I ate enough croissants to make up for it. So.
Wonderful. And our next guest is Dr. Joseph Flynn.
Hi, I'm Joseph Flynn from Seattle Children's Hospital, University of Washington. And my fun fact is that when we had to have an emergency faculty meeting after the departure of one of our faculty members, I enticed the entire division to my home by promising them Manhattans. And now they're all Manhattan drinkers.
Wonderful. Well, this is a great panel. We are awaiting one more panelist, but I think we will start our discussion and she will join us when she can. So tonight we're going to start with Dr. Rowe, who is going to tell us a little bit about the ASBN Foundation.
That is correct. I joined the board of the ASBN Foundation this past year, and it's been really exciting to hear more about what the foundation does and how people can help support it. So a lot of people don't know why we have a separate ASBN Foundation. Why can't I just donate to ASBN? And it turns out it's for tax reasons, like many things that we do. And because ASBN does lobbying, you can't just donate money to ASBN. So there's a separate ASBN Foundation that helps to support the mission of the ASBN. So the things that you can support are things like travel grants. We all know how important it is for trainees to get grants to be able to come to meetings like this, to meet us, to show us their research. So the ASBN Foundation helps to support those. You can also support the lectureships. We had the Bill Schnaper lectureship yesterday and the Adrian Spitzer lectureship this morning. And both of those are looking for funds to be able to continue in the future so that we continue to remember them over time. And then there's also awards that you can donate, including the Leadership Development Program. So a lot of us have been through the Leadership Development Program, and it's a really fantastic program and something that I encourage all my junior faculty to participate in as well. And then you can just donate to the general fund. There's always going to be things that we can't predict that the ASPN wants to support. So please go to the website, look up the ASPN Foundation, anything from $5 to $500 to $5,000, that we're happy to put your money to good use.
Absolutely. It's a great cause. And if you're a friend of the podcast, I will be going to council with hat in hand asking for more mics. And that's the kind of things that we need. So thank you for giving us that overview, Dr. Rowe. We're going to move on to the programming that we had today at ASB. And it was a busy day packed with a lot of important sessions. I'm going to start with asking Dr. Flynn and Dr. Brady a little bit about, in general, all the hypertension programming that was part of ASPN. Yesterday, we had Dr. South on, and he spoke a little bit about, you know, his area of interest and expertise. So we've had some discussion about, in general, about hypertension. But I had some questions for the two of you. But first, Dr. Brady, please tell us your overall impression. What new things have we learned from all the sessions you've attended? What's happening?
I'm always really impressed with the caliber of work being done by everybody in our society. I think it's really inspiring and really impressive. And the session that I moderated, you know, one of the things I came back with was, or I guess there were two things that I came back with, is really I think we as pediatricians are blessed with the challenge of really promoting cardiovascular health across the lifespan. I think that this is really where the future of medicine is. And in fact, one of my mentors is Dr. Larry Apple, and he once shared with me that he's an adult medicine physician who authored the DASH guidelines and or the DASH diet initial studies. And he shared with me that if he could go back in time, he would go back in time and become a pediatrician so that he could work to prevent cardiovascular disease. And so I think that we are in a really great place to really make a big difference in children and in our future adults. And so I think that was one of the things that I was really impressed upon, is how important it is to really focus on cardiovascular health promotion across the lifespan. And every time that I hear talks, and maybe I'm a little biased because I do a lot of research with obesity, but I really think that we as pediatric nephrologists need to remember some of those general pediatric tenets of prevention in terms of obesity, because a lot of the cardiovascular disease research really comes down to, certainly there are other risk factors, but a lot of it, obesity really is one of the main risk factors that we really need to address. So those were the two big things after I was impressed with all the work that I came back with.
Yes, I mean, it's definitely the need of the day. And the pandemic, I think, has shown us that there is a lot more work that needs to be done. I think pediatric nephrologists across the country have noticed how many more young people with high blood pressure we're seeing in our clinics now. Mm-hmm. Dr. Flynn, what was your impression overall of the conference?
Well, like Tammy, I think there's been some great information shared. The session yesterday was interesting. It addressed, it was hypertension potpourri, so there was a variety of topics. But, you know, we had two of our pediatric cardiology colleagues who spoke with us, Dr. Elaine Urbina and Dr. Carissa Baker-Smith, focusing on ways of assessing for the target organ effects of high blood pressure in children, and how do we determine which is the best parameter to look at cardiac damage, and how do we assess vascular health? Mm-hmm. And there had been a comment, I think, on the first day from in one of the talks or by one of the questioners about inability to really assess vascular health non-invasively, which actually is not correct, because you can do pulse wave velocity or you can do flow-mediated dilatation. Mm-hmm. And while most of these tools are still more research-oriented, I think particularly pulse wave velocity may soon find a role in clinical management. We're showing in our Ship Ahoy cohort, for example, that even modest elevation of blood pressure can lead to accelerated pulse wave velocity, which is, you know, very early sign of vascular damage from high blood pressure. And so I think, you know, this is probably the next mm-hmm. sort of tool that will become more commonly used.
Mm-hmm. Also, what is your best guesstimate? How long before it becomes standard of care?
Well, so, you know, it's interesting. So I went to the Renal Physicians Association meeting about a month ago, and one of the exhibitors at the meeting was SigmaCore that makes, or I guess it's AtCore is the company, mm-hmm. that makes the SigmaCore pulse wave velocity mm-hmm. device. And so a little factoid is that the Renal Physicians Association actually got a billing code created for pulse wave velocity assessment, so that actually you can charge for this, at least in adult medicine, and which is a little plug for becoming an RPA member, by the way. But getting back to the topic at hand, you know, I don't think it would be that long before we actually find a clinical application for this.
And I think, you know, one of the things that I was really struck by, I think it was Dr. Urbina's talk, that these changes in pulse wave velocity, so measures of arterial stiffness, precede hypertension. Mm-hmm. And so again, if we're really focusing on primordial prevention, if there are things that we can do to identify kids at risk before they actually develop overt hypertension, I think that's really a big opportunity. And so I think as more and more data, particularly with the Shipahoy cohort and others, you know, I think if we are able to show that, I mean, we can make a real big difference.
Very exciting, and lots of advances, I think, in the world of hypertension and especially obesity associated mm-hmm. hypertension over the past years. Now, are we due for an update for ambulatory blood pressure monitoring guidelines?
You answer that.
We are due for an update of the ambulatory blood pressure guidelines. An update has been written, and I can only say that it has been written and it will soon be published, actually I think within the next 6 weeks, but I can't tell you anything about what's in it.
Well, you heard it first on the ASPN podcast, go Sediment! no hints even? Can we forget about systolic load?
All I can say is that we published a review paper in the November issue of Hypertension mm-hmm. that you might want to look at.
Yes.
As it addresses this topic of blood pressure load on ambulatory blood pressure monitoring.
First authored by Mark Bitsneffis, and it's A Case for Change. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I did go through that, mm-hmm. hence the question. But anyway, well, thank you for that information, Dr. Flynn. Now, we're also joined by Dr. Jones. If you would just introduce yourself.
I'm Deborah Jones. I'm a pediatric nephrologist at Vanderbilt.
And is there any fun fact about you that you would like to share with us?
I don't know if you think it's fun, but I've learned to crochet and make quilts in the past 3 years.
Oh, wonderful.
All right.
We had someone else yesterday who was also doing crochet, so maybe there's a crochet club in the future, too.
I don't think it's relaxing.
Relaxing is exactly what we said, yes. All right. Well, this is good timing because we were going to move on to the session that you were part of earlier today. And I have, I just want to ask you quickly, what was your impression after listening to all the talks from the speaker session?
I was actually extremely excited.
What new things have we?
Well, I mean, I've always been very interested in the autosomal dominant tubular interstitial disease. And I've just begun actually identifying that, I would say, in the last 5 to 6 years of my career. I don't know what I thought about it before then. Now I can kind of look back at families that I should have probably thought about it. But to think that there could be a potential treatment for that is very exciting. And I liked the innovation that Dr. Wolf took to find potential treatments. I think he had amazing tools. Right. And then we heard about the new treatments for hydroxyluria, which are also amazing and mm-hmm. exciting. And I think the last talk was just incredibly exciting to think we might have a treatment for cystinosis that wouldn't be terribly toxic, that could change. I mean, it's just amazing to me the pictures that she showed of whatever she called those things that funnel into the...
The nets.
Yes, to share their enzymes and their lysosome. I didn't quite understand it. I think we could do a stem cell transplant on an infant and change their whole course. Right. Is powerful.
We've had 4 patients.
I was just going to say, what was really exciting for me about that session is that some of these rare diseases where we might see 1 every 5 years, that there are treatments coming along, because those are really tough populations to find treatments for. So having 4 in a row talks about all of these rare diseases where there are treatments available, I think is really exciting for pediatric nephrology.
And though we have treatments for cystinosis, you know how onerous it is to take those drugs.
I've
been following the stem cell therapy story, and I'm super impressed. I think that could have a huge impact.
It's not just the kidney, not just the eye.
Yeah,
everything.
The whole body.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Right. I think they said something about melanin being deposited back, and I was like,
they're no longer blonde.
Mind blowing. That is it. It's very rarely that we can say that something is mind blowing. Go ahead.
Well, actually, this is probably a good thing. The one good thing about the fact that everybody had to record their talks prior to the meeting, because I was at another session learning about how to be a better journal editor, so I didn't hear that. But now I can go back and watch the recorded talks. Mm-hmm. Although I would not ever encourage the PAS to do this to people again. I will make that clear, and I think Michelle would agree.
Yes,
with
yes. Never
Please
again.
No.
Joseph, you don't want to record 1 slide at a time
no.
for your talks.
Well, I did that, but I think that I've done it 2 years in a row, and that is sufficient.
And I cheated, and I told them, it didn't work for me, so here's my Zoom talk. And they said, okay.
Well, you're the second person that I heard say that they
were. I wish I had done
that. I know, why did I not talk to you?
Well, I hope the PAS leadership listens to the sentiment, so our sentiments are well known to them. And of course, your talk with the magnesium. Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
What is your best way to administer oral magnesium for that balance of no diarrhea but good magnesium levels? If it goes above 1, I'm happy. You know that. So, what is your best way to administer this? Which preparation?
You know, I'll tell you what I do. It's not based on anything evidence-based or anything like that. The child that I presented, he did not have any problems with, amazingly, magnesium gluconate. But I have had other children, most of them have like Gittleman's and things like that. And I have to try different preparations. I have to try smaller doses and try to work up to a dose and more frequent doses, which is very difficult, actually.
Right.
But one of them went from oxide to gluconate, and she's on glycinate now. And she found that the glycinate for her did not cause diarrhea. But so it's just trial and error. I don't know which ones. I mean, I have a table of which ones are supposed to have less GI effects, but it seems to be
more
individual on the patient's behalf. And so I had a question earlier about that, but I guess we need to do a little more looking into that.
Personalized medicine.
By trial and error.
Hopefully we're getting beyond that
now. High snips.
Wonderful, Dr. Jones. So we're going to segue now very awkwardly from magnesium to homeostasis.
Sounds wonderful.
And so, Shaina, it was a wonderful session, actually. I cannot recall when we had a workshop that was that well attended. Mm-hmm. I think I can say that. It was informative and very hopeful. But I had a question for you from the session about, and everybody's welcome to pitch in. So I said that, you know, I'm going to ask you a question about 2 kinds of access. So one is, of course, we spent a lot of time talking about access for our little neonates. But as I was sitting through the session, I was thinking, well, you know, the best centers in the country are offering these therapies now. And it seems like if you live in the wrong zip code, we still have to tell our families that this baby is not salvageable. So what thought has been, you know, placed into that, considering that this is our conference of Jedi warriors?
That is a great question. Before that, I just want to, you know, give kudos to the 2 Hope moderators for our session today.
Absolutely.
Dr. Herer and Dr. Arikan, they thought it out really well and tried to make this a very interactive session. I have not seen other sessions at the meeting that were interactive like this, so that was wonderful. In terms of access, you know, I'm actually more hopeful than the picture that you have presented. Many centers are now getting these therapies, so it's mm-hmm. not just the places like Seattle or Lurie or, you know, Cincinnati mm-hmm. that have these machines now. There are other smaller programs which are getting these therapies, and we are trying to create these groups where smaller centers can, reach out to us and we can discuss cases. And for Carpe Diem, for example, we have a collaborative called Iconic, which ultimately is going to be a research-based collaborative, but right now it's mostly the places which have done one treatment in 5 months where they're like, okay, this went wrong for us. How do we manage this better next time? So we're trying to do that. And then the other thing is, think of this in kind of like your big complex cardiac surgery cases, right? Patients get transported to a bigger center for some of those complex surgeries if they mm-hmm. have challenging cases. So some patients might need to be transferred to other bigger programs because
Absolutely.
Not
right.
every program will be able to maintain competency in terms of nursing training and education. So I think most centers will be able to provide some degree of therapy, and then some advanced care will have to probably go to the bigger centers.
True. And I think really the challenge there is not in the acute care field, but it is like once the child has been established on that, and how do you then transition to outpatient chronic dialysis if they need it?
But I was talking about this with David Askenazi mm-hmm. in the poster session, and where I think it's a I hate to use the phrase paradigm shift, but it really, I think we're at a turning point where these babies actually, there is a viable therapy so that you can say, well, I'm sorry, we don't have this for your baby here, but your baby can survive, but we have to send your baby mm-hmm. to a bigger center, just like what Shaina said about complex congenital heart disease. And, you know, but we have to change the thinking of our colleagues that this is actually now a treatable, particularly the babies that are essentially born with end-stage kidney disease.
Right.
This is actually a treatable condition, much more readily treatable than it has been in the past.
That's right, actually. You know, I think that one of the challenges that everybody faces is getting buy-in from all the, you know, stakeholders, and especially the neonatologists. So it was really very encouraging to see Dr. Herer up there and, you know, kind of spearheading that. And I think we had a good audience from the neonatologists, too. So I think more and more center, and again, Shaina, I was not trying to make it sound like it's all like doom and gloom, but just that thought occurred to me that, you know, this is fantastic. This is the shining, you know, castle on the thing. But, you know, where would my, you know, single mom who's unable to, you know, even make it to my appointments find the resources to travel to Cincinnati or Seattle, right? So
true. And again, we are hoping, you know, this will be like once they get stabilized on, because ultimately CRRT is only going to be a bridge until they get to peritoneal
right.
dialysis.
Yes.
So hopefully once, if they need to go to a bigger center, they get stabilized there, they can have their PD catheter placed and then, yeah, transition back.
And if you are one of those smaller centers that's starting up a neonatal CRRT program, Shaina gives a great grand rounds on mm-hmm. Neonatal CRRT, so give her a call and she'll tell you all about it.
Yes, that's the message we want to say, is that help is available. So, you know, reach out to your colleagues who are doing this across the country, and they were all represented in the workshop today, so that was excellent. Any last tips and tricks for with your experience with using these new therapies?
I think it's always good to have a good team of all the different specialists that we discussed today, whether it's the neonatologist or the intensivist, having your nursing colleagues, the pharmacist. So engaging everyone early on is important when you're developing your protocols, when you're mm-hmm. trying to think about what device are you going to use, what extra support might these patients need, because we cannot work in isolation. It cannot be that my division has given me money to buy this machine and we are starting the therapy tomorrow. It has to be a team.
Is palliative care on your team?
Absolutely. And I was going to bring that up in the second case today, you know, where we discussed how the patient, I mean, that particular patient was already somebody who was prenatally diagnosed. But we often have situations where congenital kidney failure is kind of realized after they are born and they've not had prenatal care. Palliative care for those patients, I mean, not to like from an end of life perspective, but like just to, I think having a shared decision making model to bring them into like providing all the support that the family needs, palliative care is absolutely an integral part of this.
Wonderful. All right. So we will keep the pace going and take another pivot and talk about another area where a lot of work needs to be done. We had that great IgA session, IgA nephropathy and IgA vasculitis session this afternoon. And we have our chair of the session, as well as one of our speakers here today. So, Dr. Nelson, let's start with you. What is the takeaway?
Yeah, well, first, you know, the pathophysiology has come a long ways in the last several years between the biomarker studies and the genetics particularly, in coming up with a multi-hit model, hit 1, 2, 3, 4. So we have a very nice model, and Dr. Capo from Italy really went through that very nicely, I think. But then as you moved on, well, great, we have the better understanding of pathophysiology, but now let's look at kids. And, you know, we have our IgA vasculitis, nephritis, and then pure IgA. And so then there were talks about really needing to define our, you know, natural history a little better.
Mm-hmm.
Try to pick out patients that may be more suitable for treatments, because many of them spontaneously resolve or do not progress rapidly. So seems like we have a credible need to look to identify biomarkers or other things that predict high risk for progression and things that you can follow as surrogates for trials, since the progression to end-stage disease takes such a long period of time. And so I think Dr. Rowe really nicely outlined the trial design is very dependent on identifying those factors first, really. So we have a long ways to go, I think. But there's some great opportunities, and one of the opportunities is CureGen, which we're not participating in directly, but there's a lot of centers that are, and I think that's there's a lot of information to be gained from that. There's, you know, a lot of clinical data. There's a biorepository to do analysis for people who have studies, and so I think that may be a great. It is a great opportunity, I think, to really further define these, you know, factors that predict progression, things that surrogates to monitor. So I think, and then finally, there are a lot of studies going on in adults that, you know, will be useful. I mean, pre-COVID, in fact, there were like at least 5 trials, and I remember the sessions then. And we'll hopefully be having results, but almost too many trials. It's hard to parse up the patients into the each trial. But I think an exciting time going forward, but we still have a lot of work to do with our pediatric patients.
Absolutely. And I was struck, Dr. Rowe, in your talk about, you know, saying that there's absolutely no pediatric clinical trials in North America right now currently for vasculitis.
Correct, yep, for HSP vasculitis, nephritis, other than the sparsentan study, which isn't a randomized control trial, there really aren't any trials ongoing. And that's mostly because it's a pediatric disease. So we're really in charge of putting those trials together and doing those trials. Nobody's going to do it for us.
Right, exactly. And you did you laid out the whole roadmap of why it is so difficult to do this. But I think that it was inspiring that, you know, there's people thinking about it and doing this next. So in the new therapies, what is your, both of you, it's a question for both of you, what do you think is coming quickest to FDA approval and for pediatrics, which of those therapies?
I can't bet on which one, because we don't really know trial progress at this point. I mean, sparsentan might be something that spins off quickly.
Quicker.
As far as the other more targeted therapies, hard to know whether these trials in adults will be successful and could be extrapolated. to pediatrics, you know.
And even if they're approved in adults and we want to use them for our teenagers, it's very hard to get these drugs approved, just from an insurance standpoint and a cost standpoint.
That is true, and I think that we're truly failing our children with the slow pace of progress that we are having in these fields. But it was an excellent session with lots of new information and lots of hope for the future.
One thing it points out, I think we need better collaboratives. I mean, we have collaboratives, but we need to, that is the secret to advancing these things. And for those of us in PNRC and others, it's really, it's going to take a lot of cooperation, not a lot of silos to really move the field forward.
I couldn't agree more, and I would add, Raul, that we also need to advocate better. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting that the ASPN in their policy meeting today, we're talking about how many different versions of rituximab are available, and none of us needed any more rituximab than we already have. And yet, here we're talking about a very common glomerular disease that affects so many of our children, mm-hmm. but we're not able to excite the right people to make them realize the importance of these drugs. And the onus of that is on us. So with organizations like the ASPN, really it's up for us to keep doing the talk and walking the walk.
Right. And I remember from last year's podcast, I think it was Dr. Flynn who mentioned that we had taken that inspiration from the children's oncology group and how they had started out with the collaboratives. But I don't know if we've had as much success as they've had to date with.
Well, the short answer is no, because what happens if your child is diagnosed with leukemia? At my place, they get entered into a clinical trial, and I see a lot of heads nodding around the table. So COG, or whatever it's called now, has, you know, developed so many different trial protocols. It's basically funnels children with various types of cancer into these studies, and we don't have a single collaborative that can sponsor clinical trials in pediatric nephrology. In fact, talking about Bill Schnapper, when Bill Schnapper was president of ASPN and I was vice president, or president-elect, whatever the term is, we had the same conversation about, you know, that we have different collaboratives that are doing great things, but we don't have the ability to sponsor a trial or provide seed funding for a trial. Yeah. And since then, the PNRC has become much more elaborate and perhaps we'll be able to move into that space. But yeah, I think it's still an unmet need.
Yeah, funding is the key for these networks. You need a core funding to fund the patient recruitment, the registries, the repositories, and then every patient, ideally in the world, would be plugged into a protocol like oncology, but we've got a long ways to go.
And I think some of that comes from just the lack of awareness about kidney disease, which results in lack of funding for kidney disease, and that was discussed in the JEDI meeting today. We are hoping to start some kind of a program where we can try to increase awareness by partnering with whether it's NKF or NephCure mm-hmm. to see how we can get more funding for kidney disease.
Well, wonderful. So it was a full day of programming and there were lots of new questions generated, which I think is always a good thing for a conference. And so we'll continue to build on all the things that we have learned so far, I hope, with all the thought leaders in the field. But today I want to take a few more minutes because we have a lot of women leaders at the table today. So I believe there are division directors and also people who've been through the leadership course, right? So I just wanted to take 5 minutes and talk about what are the challenges of being a woman leader. And Priya, I'll pick on you first.
So that it's intimidating to be asked to represent women leaders. So I'm really glad you're asking everyone at the table. I'd like to start with a positive comment. It's 2022, and two out of the three most prestigious awards that the ASPN gives has gone to women.
Yes.
And the presidential gavel has just been handed to a woman. So I think it's worth taking a step back and looking at our society and realizing we're making tremendous headway in the right direction. The problem is that it's not enough. We know from history that having a woman president doesn't mean that that's equity for all women. So when I think of my journey in the last 2 years as a division head, of course, there was the pandemic to compound all of the problems. We started an ASPN division head meeting, and it was part of the reason I started was because I needed support and help. I didn't have the mentorship. No one prepares you for that job. It's not quite like going from assistant to associate to professor. And the things that struck me were the things that I needed, a lot of people needed. And I think specifically women leaders need mentorship. At the division head level, there are a number of very, very accomplished women, but the higher up you go, the representation starts to drop. I think if you look at department chairs, if you look at CEOs, presidents, vice presidents, the women representation there is limited. So it's really hard to get that kind of mentorship as you go through your career. I think that we need to redefine what success is. So for me in particular, all my mentors have, many of them have been men, and many of them have been extraordinarily successful men whose work hours were different than I could have with my two children and my working husband. The roles that their wives played in their lives were different than the role that my husband plays in my life. And that's not to say that any of it is right or wrong, but we need to redefine what success is. And we need those type of that kind of representation. It needs to be openly discussed.
Right.
I think, so Priya, you and I had a wonderful conversation the other day. And I think one of the challenges is I think, and of course, this is not meant to be universal because you can't make a sweeping statement, but I think some women have trouble promoting themselves and to say, I did a good job. I did a thing. I did this wonderful thing. And I think it can be really challenging to do that. And so just a few months ago, I took on the role of vice chair of clinical research at Hopkins. And that has been my passion, is to promote faculty. And, you know, not just women, but to make sure somebody is the cheerleader to show, like, you've done this really awesome thing and everybody needs to know about it.
Right.
And so I love when women bring up other women. And it shouldn't necessarily just be that, but I think that that is something that really is helpful. And a little intimidating, but I have one of the biggest champions across the table for me. So I would never be where I am today without Dr. Flynn. And he really has been that amazing champion from the very beginning for women, for young faculty, and really helps promote people. So it's great to have people like that to really bring you up. And I think hopefully as more people, you know, to go through the leadership program and what have you, we'll keep moving that forward.
That's I think, one of the biggest things that Dr. Mayen was here on in the first episode talking about the leadership development program and about how many graduates there are from it who are now leading divisions. And so I think that that's really very good. That is something that ASPN needs to promote and be loud about, just like all the women faculty.
I would say one of the things that I'm very passionate about is the retention and mentoring of a mid-career woman. So women who are just starting out in their faculty positions, they have mentoring thrown upon them. They get mentors assigned. They have mentors that they find. Everybody knows you need a mentor. And then you are promoted to associate professor, and then everybody backs away. Now you know what you're doing. You have your career path. You don't need mentors anymore. And that's exactly when you need a mentor. I've seen so many really good physicians and pediatric nephrologists leave the field at that point. They go to industry, they, you know, go part-time, they do something else. And it's really a shame because they have a lot that they can offer the field.
Yeah, I would agree and echo what Michelle said completely. And I think that's why lately I've been looking for leadership training courses for some of my mid-level faculty. And it strikes me there are options now, which there weren't before, but many of the leadership courses are not really geared towards women because some of the issues that we have are unique. Mm-hmm. For example, this redefinition of what a day is going to look like. Some of us, you know, some of my faculty might have to leave at 3 o'clock. Some of my faculty might have to leave early to pick up a sick child. That doesn't mean that the work is not done. It might mean that they have different hours. It might mean that they have a different timeline. The work is still extraordinary. It's still high quality. It still deserves to be praised and noticed. And I feel like we do need to provide mentorship for mid-level women and above, and we need to have specific leadership training for them.
I cannot agree more, Priya, because, you know, I feel that, like, you know, it's a desert when you get to associate. And then it's like, okay, am I just supposed to figure out everything on my own? And that is when you need the push. And I think, like, just at that is the age where you start questioning some of your life choices too. Like, do I really need to do this? Do I really need to, you know?
I question my life choices every day.
You know, like Fred Astaire and Ginger Roberts doing everything backwards in heels. I mean, how long am I going to dance this dance? Right? How would established faculty who happen to be men, how would you advise them to be good allies and help women faculty?
I think Tammy brought it up so well. When Tammy told me the story of how Joseph called out Manels.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph is a man.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these people were his friends. So to me,
yes.
When Tammy told me that, I think that's exactly what we need. Or when I was at Minnesota, I started a book club for
mm-hmm.
women. And I didn't call it a book club for women. I said it was a book club to start discussing equity between men and women. But only women showed up, so it became a book club for women.
Oh.
But we're the ones who know about the problem. We need men to sit with us, chat about it, talk about it, discuss it, right?
Mm-hmm. Perhaps we need mentoring of the mentors too. But you know, I have two women faculty. I have one that's just, you know, raising a family, young kids. I'm trying to be really flexible, but I don't always know what they need. I don't know.
That's
advice
a really important point,
given.
And I think that could be a great workshop for next year's ASPN,
mm-hmm.
a mentoring
Absolutely.
Session for
right.
how to effectively mentor women faculty.
Yeah,
and you know, I think it does, I mean, there are, for better or for worse, many men that are in a more privileged, maybe, position, and they have to be taught also,
mm-hmm.
but then, you know, like we've had junior faculty who have come through and said, I'm not gonna work more than 0.6, and I'm like, okay. And actually, recently, I told one of my junior faculty that they probably ought not to be working full time to mm-hmm. be able to do all the things that they need to do, and in my system we can accommodate that, and we just, you know, and I have a very understanding chair currently, and my previous chair, who was Bruder, was also very understanding, and we're able to be flexible to recognize that. And it wouldn't have to be a woman faculty member either, for that matter, if one of the you know, there needs to be, you know, just a shift in how we think about how people do their jobs. And, you know, I tell people, you can ask any of the division faculty in my division, I tell them, I don't care where you're doing your work. You don't have to come to the office. And this was before the pandemic. I know you're going to get the work done, and you have whatever flexibility you need to do that. And so, and I'm sure that other people,
mm-hmm.
other division heads are the same way, or would hope that they would be. And
particularly in COVID, we were.
Well, in COVID,
we
were all
really helped
out.
Bring out those things, but that will persist, you know, allowing the flexibility.
But let me tell you, Raul, the fact that you're even asking or identifying, I have two women faculty and I think I need to figure out how to mentor them better, I think it's a huge step in the right
mm-hmm.
direction. I think starting the dialogue. That's
yeah,
what
I don't
is.
Want them to retire early or quit because they're dissatisfied. You can have a family. I have a wife who's a physician and critical care doctor, so I've been used to passing the kids
right.
back and forth, you know, and what a challenge. So having a physician spouse, it really
yeah.
helps some. I mean, for me, understanding the demands.
Absolutely. Well, we're not starting at the bottom rung in pediatric nephrology. Mm-hmm. I will say that. I think surgeons have it worse, if I can say it, and engineers, which I have a little bit of a window into being a faculty wife of an engineering professor, that the landscape there is like very, very bleak for women for advancing in their fields. So, but I think that these are all great initiatives. Your meeting for the directors and all the other thoughts that were also going on in the JEDI session. So I want to end with that tonight. Thank you all for coming. It's been a great discussion and a great day of programming at ASPN. We do have another episode that will be recorded on Zoom for tomorrow's programming. I want everybody to make sure that you subscribe. Is that the right word? Subscribe. Yes, so that you won't miss that episode. And this episode will be the last episode that we are doing live from Denver. So I hope all of you have a great conference, and we will see you with episode 4 for 2022 in about a week. Thank you and goodbye.